So you've all heard Mr. Ost Sr. and Gerald Ost and Philip Ost and others give messages or mention over the years the King of the South versus the King of the North, the King of the North being the led by the, you know, the beast power pushing against the King of the South, which will in the future at some time be a caliphate of, or a confederation of Muslim and Arab nations that will be pushing into the north, into Europe and the UK, antagonizing, creating war, creating problems. And with that having been the case, many of us are watching European news and UK news and wondering when they're going to get tired of some of the the antics and the provocation by Muslims, by extremists especially. You've seen Europeans run over at Christmas markets and London Bridge and various places with cars, knifings, acid that's thrown on faces of natives in England. It's a lot of this Muslim push it's increasing. I don't know who's here heard about the Muslim grooming gangs in the UK? Muslim grooming gangs. Okay, maybe three people. All right, so it's been going on for about 20 years, roughly, plus or minus. You can, if you want to look this up, you can look up on the BBC or any, you can pick a left-wing, a liberal, center, or right news source, and you're going to find information about it. I won't go into the details because it's really quite awful, but it's grooming could, you know, it's not like they're grooming dogs. They're grooming young British girls, vulnerable British girls, and getting them involved in things that you can imagine, if you will. They would better be called not grooming gangs, but rape gangs. So that, along with a lot of other things that's going on there, is making headlines, and some people are speaking out about it. So over the last few years, I see the tension in England rising in the UK regarding the immigrant Muslim sort of takeover, and crime is up. I'll be going there for the feast in Wales, so that should be interesting to see some of this. But even the term grooming gangs just sounds so innocent. You know, it's amazing how the media can take something so awful and clean it up and make it sound like a positive thing. Or they can take other historical words that were considered good and make them bad. You have examples there from that. But as you know, Charlie Kirk was assassinated a couple of weeks ago. He had mentioned that the British there are now around 29% in London, and the rest are all immigrants coming in. And his death sparked the largest protest in London history, 3 million man march, 3 million in the streets, led by a variety of men, but Tommy Robinson was one of them. So he's a journalist and an activist that's been speaking out against these grooming gangs for a long time, and the government really wants him to be quiet about it, but he's not stopping. He set out a cry from the streets of England. He's expressed what many over there, even in the Western world as well, sense that their culture and their identity is being lost. So I just want to read a few excerpts from the speech he gave. I'm not sure when he gave it exactly, but I had a chance to catch it. He says, "It feels like our culture has been eroded, dissolved, and replaced. See, we don't have a homeland to run to. This is our home. This is our darkest hour. In World War II, we stood up with the crown to fight for this country. Our grandparents died for this country. They helped build this country just so the establishment could give this country away. The UK has been rug pulled from us, and yet our mayor of London laughs at us," which the mayor of London is also Muslim, by the way. "Our government bows to extremists, societies within our society that have no benefit to us. They don't shop in our businesses. They boycott us. The government's created a desperate state where natives no longer feel seen or heard. Literally, we're not even seen in London anymore. We are the minority. So to my better natives, I know you have hope, but you're not optimistic. Hope's for the beggar. Change is coming. Change is your voice. Stand up for your children, for your homes, and for your homelands. He says, I'm not calling for violence, but I'm calling for an awakening. The country has been rug pulled, and we have nowhere else to go. I guess no one else has heard this speech, and most don't know about the 3 Million Man March, but I don't mention this just because it's news or political. I mention it because these are all parts of prophecy marching forward. You're getting the King of the South forming slowly but surely, I'd say rapidly, coming into Europe and the UK, and the natives are getting more and more tired of them being there. You're going to see conflict in the future, and it will lead to prophecy. But if you listen to the speech, you can hear the sort of the desperation in his voice. He sounds much better than I do with the British accent, which I lack. But we know it's prophesied to happen, that the foreigner will rise up and rule over, but it's still painful for some to live through. The words of Tommy are raw, and they speak to the real human longing, the longing for a homeland. And everyone wants to maintain their homeland that they have, their native homeland, or to find one if they've lost theirs. And I understand there are real refugees out there that have been displaced, that are seeking a new homeland, but specifically, most of the Muslims are not seeking refugee status. Many are more concerned with demographic jihad, or you could say womb jihad is another term, a total takeover of these areas. If you want to look at other examples of displacement or people losing their homeland and longing to go back to the homeland, let's go back to the Bible. Let's look at Israelites. The Israelites were carried away into Assyria in 722 BC. So the northern ten tribes were carried off in 722, roughly for a couple of decades. But people often forget it wasn't just the lost 10 tribes. The city of Lachish was carried off as well, and that was a Jewish city. So some of them would have returned, the Jews, back to Israel. But the lost 10 tribes migrated north and west around the Black Sea and pushed into the Celtic countries, into France and Scandinavia and Ireland and the UK. Judah was exiled to Babylon in 586 BC, over 100 years later. They longed to go back to the homeland. They sang songs about it. We still sing songs today about that. They were longing to go back, singing by the river. Many did go back to Israel and rebuild their nation there. Jews were scattered across the earth after Rome was destroyed in Jerusalem in 70 AD. And millions of Jews have returned to Israel since 1948. The lost 10 tribes, of course, are still scattered. And again, you do have modern refugees displaced by wars and famine and tyrannical governments that are in search of a homeland, that need a homeland. So from one end of history to the other, people for thousands of years long for a homeland. What about me? What about you? What do you picture? What would your homeland look like if you could pick one? Would it be a cottage by the sea? A vineyard on a hillside? A cabin in the woods? A farm with animals or a ranch? My wife 10 years ago told me she wanted to start a bison ranch. I said, babe, we don't have Ted Turner kind of money. Yeah. We could buy some land and have 5 or 6 cows. 5 or 6, that's our limit. We're not buying bison. You need a 10-foot fence for that. But each of us dreams differently. But the thread is the same. We all in this room and all people across the world want peace and safety and prosperity and a place to call our home. That's what Tommy Robinson was crying for. Whether you love him, hate him, don't know who he is, that's not the point. That speech, that voice represents people in China, people in Japan, Russia, Ukraine, Gaza, Israel, South America. It's the same universal emotion, the universal desire for a homeland. So ignore the politics of it and focus on the longing in everyone's human heart to have a place for their family, for the future. That's what the Fall Holy Days tells us God will provide. The feasts are not just about remembering Israel's time in the wilderness without a homeland. It's about imagining and dreaming of the world to come, the true homeland that God is preparing for us. And these feasts tell us that a homeland is coming. Hebrews 11, verse 13 reads, "All these people were still living by faith when they died. They didn't receive the things that they promised. They only saw them and welcomed them from a distance, admitting that they were foreigners and strangers on this earth, as we are. People will say such things that they're looking for a homeland of their own, but if they'd been thinking of the homeland that they had left, they would have had the opportunity to return. Instead, they were longing for a better homeland, or, as we are, a heavenly one, a heavenly homeland. Therefore, God is not ashamed to be called their God, for he has prepared for them a homeland." So the fall feasts remind us that God will restore his people, Israel, to their land, all 12 tribes, but also return all nations to their rightful inheritance and establish a world of peace and prosperity and abundance under Christ. The promise is of a homeland. God tied his feast to the land and inheritance. In Leviticus, he commands Israel to dwell in booths, temporary dwellings, to remember that they had no homeland when he brought them out of Egypt when they wandered for 40 years as well. But notice the Feast of Tabernacles always looks forward to, it points to a permanent home, a promised land where his people will be rooted in the thousand-year millennium and beyond in New Jerusalem. And the prophets echo this hope. I don't want to read the whole passage, but you can read Isaiah 61 on your own time. Isaiah 61, verse 4. "And they shall rebuild the old wastes, and they shall raise up the former desolations. And so you will inherit a double portion in your homeland, and everlasting joy will be yours." A double portion in your homeland, and everlasting joy. That sounds pretty awesome to me. Today, the world is partially in ashes. Not totally physically, but certainly spiritually. During the 3.5 years of the Great Tribulation, it will be totally broken. A landscape of decay, broken families, confusion, violence, and hopelessness. But Isaiah promises beauty for ashes. Isaiah 61, verse 1, there's a passage that proclaims the mission of Christ. It's a beautiful passage and hard to beat, and I'm sure at the feast you're going to hear it read at least once. "He has sent me to bind up the brokenhearted, to proclaim freedom for the captives, and release from darkness for the prisoners. To proclaim the year of the Lord's favor and the day of vengeance for our God, to comfort all who mourn, and provide for those who grieve in Zion, to bestow on them a crown of beauty instead of ashes, the oil of joy instead of mourning, and a garment of praise instead of a spirit of despair. They will be called oaks of righteousness, a planting of the Lord for the display of his splendor." By the end of the Great Tribulation, the start of the millennium, the people that are left on earth, which if we have 8 billion people today, by all accounts, it would be easy to estimate that 90% will be gone. The 10% plus or minus that will be left will be, as we said 100 years ago, in shell shock or post-traumatic stress syndrome. You pick any term you want. They're going to be totally broken, and they're going to need to be healed. They're going to need physical healing and spiritual healing. But when you read that scripture, I've read through over that scripture my whole life, and I want to ask you, who do you think of when you think of the brokenhearted? When you read Isaiah 61, "He has sent me to bind up the brokenhearted." Just take a second to think, who do you think of? Do you think of people that are born with deficiencies, that are born with disabilities, people that from third world countries, people in America, people with all kinds of addictions and ailments? I've always thought of the brokenhearted as other people my whole life. Always. And I'm sure most of you do as well. But when my dad died, in the year leading up to it, it was so painful. I almost felt like, well, I was certainly brokenhearted, but I thought that that scripture applied to me as well, because I'm waiting on trumpets. I'm waiting to be reunited with my father and to be restored spiritually and emotionally, to be reconnected with not only my father, but other family members. And if I think of my mom, it does break my heart that her health has been so rough over the years, and she suffered. We need Christ's return desperately. And I need it, maybe not as much as all these third world countries, because my life is blessed. This is not a sob story. My life is extremely blessed. Most of the world needs God's return more than me and more than most of us in this room. But I lost track of where I was. My point is that even at times, we are the brokenhearted. There are times in our lives when we are the brokenhearted in Isaiah 61, and we need God's healing power and restoration as much as anyone. The world is, and will be more so before the end, covered in spiritual ashes and ugliness and despair and corruption. But on the bright side, God promises renewal, beauty, and joy. And the feast is a picture of that restoration. That's why we look forward to it every year. That's why we're so excited. You know, God scattered his people, but he will return them to their own land. History is full of scattering. Israel sinned and was scattered to be removed from their homeland so many times through history because they broke his laws. By the Assyrians, by the Babylonians, by the Romans. Today, of course, only Judah partially inhabits the modern state of Israel. Someone should tell Ted Cruz that. I don't know if you saw the interview with Ted Cruz and Tucker Carlson, but most of the world, they just forget about the lost 10 tribes. They only think of Judah in Israel. But God's going to restore all 12 tribes. God promises he will regather them for the sake of time. I'll quickly reference just a few scriptures. I won't go through them in great detail. But God shares that promise in Jeremiah 23. Greater than the Exodus, God will bring his people back to their own homeland. Ezekiel 36, verse 24. I will take you from among the heathen and bring you into your own homeland. Isaiah 14, verse 1. Israel will be restored to their homeland. Strangers will join them, but Israel will be rooted again. These are prophetic scriptures, and they're encouraging. This is what the fall feasts point to, not just freedom from sin and slavery, but restoration of a physical homeland. And the homelands all over the world will be healed, physically healed, with those healing waters coming out from the Mount of Olives that are going to go down to the Mediterranean and the Dead Sea. And the Dead Sea is very dead. I think it's one-third salt. You can float there and read a newspaper for hours if you like. But the feast points to healing of land, families, and hearts. And the scriptures tells us that the deserts will bloom, the land will be healed, the waste places become like Eden. Imagine farming without pesticides, fungicides, insecticides. I mean, insects and funguses and bacteria and blight and mildew and mold, they just attack everything. Imagine an orchard like the Dobbins orchard. Imagine I can grow peaches without brown rot. It's not just the earth, the land, the soil that would be healed. It's the soul. It's the spirit in man. That's the sickness in this world that's really driving the physical decay. Jeremiah talks about a new covenant, a law written on the hearts, a heart of stone to a heart of flesh. Families will live in peace. owning their own land, not losing it, as Tommy was talking about in the UK, through the inheritance tax, where you know that our country is doing away with the inheritance tax for farms, where each family can inherit the farm. The UK taxes inheritance on farms passing down from generation to generation so heavily that they can't afford to keep the farm in the family. That's going to stop. Families will live in peace, owning their own land, producing their own food, and enjoying the abundance of the earth. Crime and poverty and violence will vanish. The godly nuclear family will be restored. You'll see that, because that's the building block of society. Marriage will be between one man and one woman. And mankind will at last learn the way of peace. And brethren, that is the homeland that we're picturing during these fall festivals. So in conclusion, today many cry out, there's nowhere left to run. I've heard Elon Musk and others say it. Even people in Israel, I've got friends there. They think if America falls, the whole world falls. And in a sense, that's true. These people don't know the prophecy that America has to fall before Christ is going to return. It's sad for us to consider, but it is going to happen. But these people are still partially right. They feel there's nowhere left to go. There really is no safe homeland. You can move to any country you want. You can build any bunker you want. There will be no safety in the time of the end. There will be no safe homeland. Nations are crumbling, they're dissolving, and national identities are being eroded. The world is lying in spiritual ashes. But the feast declares something different. God will restore his people, Israel, and he will return every nation to its inheritance, to their respective lands. And he will heal the land, the families, and the hearts of the people. Again, Hebrews 11 reminds us that Abraham looked for a better country, a homeland that is a heavenly one. And God has prepared that homeland for him and for us. So as we go to our temporary booths this feast, let us remember, we are strangers and pilgrims now on this earth. But soon, Christ will return. And when he does, he's going to establish a true homeland, a permanent homeland, our homeland, a place of peace, of prosperity, and beauty, where every man will sit under his vine and fig tree unafraid.